So on behalf of the class of 1977, I want to thank all of you for coming and joining us for this opportunity to listen to and talk with Barry O'Connell. Now, we knew him as Barry O, and we have a special connection with him in that it was his first year here when we became a freshman. So our class has always had a unique, a unique relationship with Barry, but I'm sure others here have. And while this is dubbed the conversation with Barry O'Connell, we think of it as the Barry Ovation, for his 50 years. So I want to put a few things in context. One is that there's 9 different reunion classes here that all have had or have had the opportunity to have had Barry O'Connell. Pretty unique. He's also been here through 6 different presidents of Amherst College, and was also here during 10 different U.S. presidents. To that point, and as a quick aside, the class of 77 had the unique history, if you will, as there was 3 different U.S. presidents while we were here at Amherst. Okay, so as I said to Barry, he said, "Well, what do we want to talk about?" And I said, "Well, look, I'm kind of a business guy, so I always think of things in terms of income statements and balance sheets. And a balance sheet, for those who aren't aware, is really a snapshot in time. And an income statement, it really is what's happened or a trend over time. So I've asked Barry to talk about some of the great trends that he's seen over his 50-year career with Amherst and some of the main events that will always be with him. And that is the introduction. And after that, let's just please welcome Barry O'Connell.
Your choice.
I'll sit for a while. I guess it's okay if I start off. Can you all hear me all right? This is really only to add to Sonnenberg's introduction. At one point, there was a possibility I would be asked to be somehow the center. I've never, as a teacher, sought to be or, in fact, achieved being the center, and I don't want to do that tonight either. So what I add is only some markers of what I have passed through here. When I came here, Amherst was all female.
Male.
No, all male, sorry. And there was no hope, it seemed, for any change in this. When I was interviewed by Bill Ward, who was the president I came to, he promised, in effect, that in a couple of years, there would be women here. Well, that didn't happen, and the trustees made it clear that they couldn't make a decision, so indefinitely we would stay male. So Liz Bruss and I, who came to the English department together, and she was the first woman in the department, and a quiet but total force, joined hands, and we organized the faculty to tell the trustees that their decision was unacceptable. And as Liz put it, it was a great combination, she said, because you don't stand for much of anything, but you make lots of noise while I do the work. It's one reason I loved her. She saw this. And we did move in our work, the faculty, to say to the trustees, you must come to the campus and explain your inexplicable decision. And the trustees left with the chair resigning, and they're making a decision to become co-ed in a few months. So of all the changes I've seen here, that was the most important to me. It's the only one I could claim having any kind of hand in, though Liz Bruss, who died early, sadly, really was the moving force. And so I came to a college which was male, and the courses were male. The book lists were, in many ways.
And the professors were largely.
There were a few women professors, but a few, and most of them resigned in time and left. So then the long passage after that is about a decade before it becomes a place where women feel it belongs to them as much as it does to men. And when that change occurred, something fundamental changed about this college. But that change had to occur, and it couldn't occur with a decision. It was very difficult. It's also the case that though we talked about and thought about, given that it was the 60s and early 70s, the bringing of African Americans to the campus in number. There were a very few, and virtually none on the faculty, too. And both Prosser Gifford, the greatest dean of the faculty I ever worked for, and Bill Ward worked hard to figure out a way to bring more black people to the faculty. But they didn't succeed, and they didn't succeed because nationally it was still a mystery in the eyes of white faculty. How do you do this? Eventually it got worked through, but one of the things that's outstanding about the college now, really outstanding, is the presence of a substantial number of African-American faculty as well as of African-American students. Still, I would say, not enough, but that says something about where the society is. The quality of both is of the highest. And I love teaching here these last 10 years because I walk into a room and I will not be able to predict the range of people who are before me of all and every kind. And it produces the most exciting possible investigations and questions that I've ever experienced here. And I've never had I've never had a bad student here. Oh, one, actually.
Call me.
So those are sort of brackets, if you will, are becoming co-educational and are moving slowly and painfully and with lots of fallbacks into a student body of that represents the faculty as well as the country. Who ever thought we could have 60% of our students on full financial aid? Now, this, of course, is also a tribute, I believe, to our alums, because that couldn't have happened without the money to make it happen,
right,
and to sustain it. For me, Biddy's sole primary achievement is that she maintained this after the president who created it, and she really maintained it. And a number of you here understand that running a college, I'm a Roman Catholic still in some measure, I think running the college is much harder than running the goddamn church. And there are many constituencies you have to be present to, and you have to persuade, often, of your seriousness and your commitment to a place they love, and it's not easily done. Early on in Biddy's time here, she'd just come back from a sort of money-raising trip to Texas, and she clearly had been seriously abused repeatedly in public settings. You know, here's a woman, here's somebody who's gay, and she got feedback this way. And she was talking to me about it, not really complaining, and I said, you shouldn't go to these places alone. And she said, well, who would I go with? And I said, you take people from the faculty. I would happily go with you. And she said, won't do. I said, what do you mean it won't do? She said, no men can possibly take this on if we're going to change. And I said, so? She said, I'm not bleeding to death. She doesn't lack bravery. She also does not lack stubbornness. I have taught here for 50 years, which I never sought to do exactly. I just kept teaching and teaching and teaching. And
couldn't find anything else to do, huh?
What is better in the whole world than teaching?
Sure. So let's open it up for some questions, if we may. Anyone here would like to pose a question to Barry? In the back. And please take off your mask.
Hi, Professor O'Connell.
Hello. Same here.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit about your experience teaching through the Inside Out program at the Hampshire County Jail, which I had the privilege of working with you in.
I'm happy to. Going back to long before I was at Amherst, it is how I met my wife, I was helping to develop programs in neighborhoods in Cambridge and in Boston. Part of a commitment to a notion I long had had that people who were just classroom teachers in the conventional sense were not going to be the kind of teachers I wanted to be. So one of those things that I did here was to teach for 2 years in the local county jail program, which one of my colleagues had set up beautifully. And I had wonderful students as my TAs. One of the things that's important about that kind of teaching is it's a reminder to you as a teacher that, A, you are where you are by accident. You could be on the other side of this, first of all. And to be reminded of that is to be reminded that you are not above or better than anyone, which I think, again, is a fundamental lesson teachers should have. Students need to feel when they come into your room that you're not playing games and you're not being superior and that you're not making them ashamed of who they are. The teaching styles I was exposed to in college had opposite ends. And I didn't like them. I did have one very great teacher, blessedly. But those are hard lessons. And the 2 years that I taught in the jail, I still can remember every single student I had and something of the enormous range of different, not just personalities, but senses of possibility. If it's the case, as I always thought it was the case, that my primary job in the classroom was to help other people believe in themselves. If you're 18, to believe in yourself is kind of miraculous, I think, and probably foolish. But you need to know that you are somebody and that you can be more than somebody. If you teach in the jail, the abyss of people's belief in themselves is beyond most people's comprehension. And that what you have to do is speak to those students in a variety of ways, and you have to look for what I call strands of hope in a situation in which is close to hopeless often. We don't support people who come out of jail at all in this society, still, even in liberal Massachusetts. So I would say that that was one of my crucial learning experiences.
Next question. Go ahead, please.
I'm not sure. Are you still teaching or have you retired fully?
It's neither dumb nor obvious. I taught last this fall, and I did not intend for it to be my last, necessarily, until the administration forced us all to wear masks, even though every student had to be vaccinated, and every faculty member had to be vaccinated, and you had to have open windows. I couldn't make a long list of all things. You try teaching people in mask and wearing a mask yourself. I can promise you that nothing happens. You have to see people's faces. You have to hear their voices. I had a student, I had 38 students at 8:30 in the morning, my typical time. And I will never forget a student named Emma Cape. Emma was from the middle of Kansas. How many students from the middle of Kansas have ever had at Amherst? Emma said to me the first day, she said, just don't forget, this is the first day of class, I'm here. And I said, Emma, well, I know you're here. She said, no, you don't. She said, I have the loudest voice in the room and I will use it and you will pay attention to it, of course. She refused to wear a mask, so she became my favorite if I had one. And I said, one day, don't you get in trouble? And she said, of course I get in trouble, she said. But I'm a senior, they have to graduate me. And she said, besides, I get straight A's usually. She said, though I don't expect them given your reputation. And then she laughed. And so even with the goddamn mask, and I really, it was the most hateful teaching experience I ever had. And had I known, because I said I'm going to do this, and the dean said she would not pay me and she would fire me. A dean I've never had any use for, I should say right now. a monster. And so I taught in a mask. I capitulated one of the few times in my life until about a third of the way through, I thought, microphones. And I got a microphone, and I used it, and I passed it around, and we began to have real interaction. But the mask still meant there were four students in the class. I never got to know. I couldn't, because they had small faces, and the mask covered their faces, essentially. And for me, that's a source of shame, that I did not get to know four students. That never happened to me before.
But you are vaccinated, though, right?
I'm not from Texas.
You asked for that.
Wait a second. We got some other Texans here. Be careful now. Jerry?
Thank you for joining us. Great seeing you.
Thank you.
Dean Epstein, in her talk this morning, said that something like, said that 50% of the students now major in a STEM field, okay? And the number of humanities students has decreased accordingly. She played some numbers with dual majors, blah, blah, blah. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. is this careerism? Is this just cool stuff is happening in STEM and, you know, with the, you know, the vaccine and technology? Is it, what's going on?
Well, you could never depend on me to tell you what's going on. but I'll do the best I can to describe what I see. Those figures are right, and they've devastated the humanities here in certain ways, though finally Biddy has begun to appoint more people in the humanities. For a while it was only STEM appointments, literally for almost 10 years. But I get remarkable STEM students in my humanities courses. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that unless we begin to think about the society we now live on, we can't make any sense of this. And why? These are all students terrified of getting jobs. Now, unfortunately, being in STEM does not mean they're going to get jobs, but they think it means that. And the college has not, in my mind, thought enough about how to respond to this. How would be an adequate response is not simple. So the many of those students who are STEM students are pre-meds. We have many more students trying to go to medical school and being turned down, by the way, unfairly. So it's a, one could cry and take on if you were in humanities, and I think that's foolish. I always think that's foolish anyway, but I think it's foolish because what's going on isn't simple. And it's not as though, when I first discovered this, I thought, oh my God, I'm just gonna teach people in the physics department, maybe, or people who are English majors only. And I've never wanted to or done that. And then I discovered 2/3 of the people in any class I was teaching were STEM students. And terrifically interesting and engaged and scared. But who could be a student these days and not be scared of the world they live in? That's a luxury beyond measure. So one of the issues that really influences me a lot and worries me a lot is how frightening it is to be 21 or 22 years of age. And that they live in a world where most adults can't give significant guidance. I certainly can't. I mean, you know, I grew up in the prosperous 50s. So I don't know what it's like to be afraid of the world I'm in. That disqualifies me from being the kind of help for any students I would like to be.
George?
Barry, talk with us a little bit about the progression of social progressivism at the college. You started with Bill Ward, who was a good friend of mine, who was a social progressive. I could name all the others who came in. Let me stop with the last three. Tom Garrity, Tony, and Biddy all had very distinct socially progressive credentials, articulated them all very well. The percentage of the student body on aid hasn't changed much since Tom Garrity. It was always around 60%. So that by itself hasn't changed. But talk with us about what has changed to make the college the socially progressive icon that it is today.
Well, I guess the first answer I would go to is a little bit opposite what you've just said, in that I don't think the campus was 60% on financial aid under Tom. But I do think that the sophistication of our admissions work has increased immensely. So to go back to my student Emma Cape, and she's not alone, if you actually go into a classroom now and you ask people where they're from or what their parents did, you hear things you would not have heard when Tom was president. That's not to fault Tom. It is to say that the two recent presidents have really worked in fascinating ways with the admission staff to recruit in a very, very different fashion. I have a former student I'm very fond of who's been teaching for 18 years in what is called the worst high school in L.A. He does amazing work, and he's actually created a union among the students, and he's done all kinds of things. We've admitted two of his students here. That's a measure. So I think the answer, to the extent there is an answer, has to do with the sophistication of the recruitment, which in turn depends on two presidents who they didn't always know what to do, but they knew the end they wanted. I think Biddy had a fuller sense than her lovely predecessor, who I worship. But nonetheless, the student body would be unrecognizable to any of you, I think. And once you sat down and talked with them, you'd be very excited. Now, you still talk with students. So you have a sense of this. The two of us share a love for Amherst athletics, which is not supposed to be what I'm interested in. And this goes back a long way, since for a long time I believe the only way we would get interesting students at Amherst was to have athletics. Because, you know, we had this sort of what I call straight out admissions progress. If you look at the teams I know, which are primarily basketball and football, the people who make up those teams are not only interesting athletes, they're over and over again first-rate students. So if you think about recruitment, finding athletes of quality who are also students of quality, that's some achievement in this world. So part of the answer to your question, I think, has to do with the increasing sophistication of our recruitment effort. I hope that helps.
Please. Richard.
Yeah. The session prior to this one was an interesting one that Rick also moderated, and it had to do with American studies in the 70s versus today. It was a very interesting discussion. And one of the themes was the broad themes of the classes, you know, 45 years ago versus those that their title suggests have a narrower focus on identity and so forth. And it was an interesting, although the point was made, well, even if the topic sounds narrow, it's still put in the context of a broader picture, et cetera. But do you have any reflections on the evolution of the American studies curriculum? And second of all, sort of related, any thoughts, preliminary thoughts about Biddy's successor, who, from what we understand, is sort of a bit of a throwback in a positive way, I guess. But any, if you have any thoughts about that choice of a president?
It's two questions here.
It's two questions.
He's only allowed one. No, go ahead, answer whatever you want.
So I did not want to be part of that panel because I think its premise was false. I came here in American Studies and found, as I wrote to the members of that panel, that what I consider an intellectually defunct enterprise.
No.
Yes. No. And I spent the first 5 years creating and offering completely new courses, which is actually what they remember, but they don't know what it was in relationship to. Andrew Jackson was never taught again after I was here. I could name a whole list of things I got off the table. And what I wanted very much, and it took a long time, was in American studies, which reflected something like the true variety of human beings in the United States. We were not doing that for a very long time. And that effort was so difficult, finally the department blew up and four of us left. And the number of admits to the department fell to about 14 a year. And only with the long-standing work of Karen Sanchez-Epler, that's another, was the department in the last 5 years rebuilt. It's now an important department. Why? Because it really teaches something like the whole of the culture. Something about identity, that's nonsense. That's something you would make up if you were coming from the right and wanted to indict the college. It's a silly idea. And it so disgusted me that I did not want to be on that panel. Plus it would have violated my whole career to be that.
So point taken. How about the second part of his question about the new president?
Well, I can't actually comment about the new president.
Because, yes, you can.
Because the new president was my student for 4 years, was my research assistant for my book, whom I helped all the way through graduate school, though he's one of the most decent, sweet people I have ever met. His test will be whether he has a ruthless bone in his body when he needs it.
Just.
I think it's an amazing choice. And if you told me the day before he called me to tell me that this was happening, that it was going to happen, I would have said, the trustees have gone mad. And gone mad because, A, the betting among me and all my colleagues was that the next president had to be a person of color, had to be female, right, and had to fit some other profile. It's clear, I mean, three of the faculty on that committee were close to me, and I didn't think they would produce Michael.
Oh, I'm glad they did. So, other questions, please.
Hi, Barry. So we came here in the fall of 73. Nixon had just left office, and we were perhaps...
That was the next summer.
That was the next summer. Yeah, I missed that. I think a lot about polarization. On the one hand, you know, bubbles are kind of warm and comfortable. But on the other hand, the big world out there isn't all looking like our bubble. And what I'm wondering is, for the faculty and the composition of the faculty and the composition of the students, how do you achieve that sort of mix, hold true to things that many of us in this room hold dear, while prepare us to live in a polarized world?
Well, of course, it's a wonderful question. And if I make an answer, it's going to sound easily solved, and it isn't. I would say that one of the things that is very, very different from the college you experienced and I experienced as a young faculty member is that it's not a particularly comfortable place. And the discomfort is not necessarily or mostly political in the way we mean those terms. It's people who feel that who they are and what their experience has been doesn't fit well with other people here. So that there's a kind of edginess, and the pandemic, of course, has not helped that because it's kept students from getting to know each other as well as they might. So I would say that it's not a solution, but it changes what you're wondering about a bit, is that it's not a bubble. To the extent that you can say that about a four-year institution with lots of money, but that many, many students aren't sure they belong here, aren't sure they dare trust their fellow classmates. Discussions, I don't find having discussions in class hard, but it's because I have to think a lot about who's there, and being, I hope, a better listener even than I ever was before. Because if you take my 38 students and I went through them with you, you'd see what I mean. Now, how can colleges be good places for young people, uncomfortable in the right ways, and prepare people for a world which is a mess. I mean, it's a mess beyond anything any of us growing up experienced. So I don't know the answer. Now, my former student, Michael, I revere and love, and he's smarter than I am, simply. So you can look to him to help.
Please.
Hi, Barry. You and I were also very much involved in the beginning of the Center for Community Engagement that sort of then disappeared almost, at least. But that was seen as a vehicle for getting the students here much more engaged in the realities of the world. And so what's happened to at least that culture, that effort, and what's your perspective on that?
You remind me of the most unhappy moment in my experience of the current president. One of her first steps, literally, was to eliminate the center. All the transportation, with no notice to anybody, volunteer organizations in the town and in the region were bereft, and she never explained it, and she was never held accountable by the trustees. It was a terrific mechanism for really terrific mechanism for students becoming engaged in a solid and learning way with a large world. I would hope that it gets restored. I still to this day hold it against her, and I don't know why she did it. It's a terrible loss.
I mean, having been on the alumni board, we never really got a good explanation either.
So I was on the board, and I tried to get her to hold a meeting, and she wouldn't do it.
Joel.
Barry, hi, thanks for coming. I teach at the University of California, as you know, and we're dealing with a lot of similar kinds of issues about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the tension there with academic freedom. And I wonder to what extent, you know, you may feel as a professor in the classroom that your academic freedom or the academic freedom of your students may be constricted by concerns about equity and inclusion.
Good question.
Well, I'm
going to...
Please repeat the question.
Okay, and Joel, you'll all of us, please speak up so we can all hear well down here. And when you speak up, please take off your mask. Essentially, the question is that, he's asking Barry to reflect on concerns of equity and inclusion and academic freedom, as in the ability to speak your mind in a classroom around the concerns of equity and inclusion. Is that a good summation, or do you want to do it again?
No.
Is that okay? That's good. That's the question.
So this is the moment where I reveal my complete stupidity. I've never had any anxiety about that here, ever, not once. I have not had a colleague with that anxiety here, not once. You can say we're all foolishly naive and taken in, but it literally is not an issue here. There's some reasons, I think, for that. One is a bit of strong defense of it, but another is what I've just talked about, the diversity of students. If you're teaching your students well, you're simultaneously negotiating complicated things about very different personal histories. But you're also having to be what I would call a presence they can trust. Now, you can't trust a presence who's changing his or her words to fit some preconception. So I do understand, I have a student, for instance, who teaches at the University of Texas, and she has to struggle with this all the time. But not here. I mean, it could go away. Such fragile things can go away. But right now, this is a kind of glorious place to be.
So let me have a rejoinder to his question. I've read articles over the last 10 years of events at Brown and some other prestigious universities where the need for safe spaces and microaggressions and things like that. Is your comment suggesting that those aren't issues here on campus?
Mostly they are not. There was a period of time where we were all concerned with creating safe spaces because of what women on campus were dealing with. But to create a safe space in your office is simply to open something, not close something.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I'm not aware of any special anxiety about that at all.
That's good news. Please.
I'm class of 1952. I did not have the advantage of having you as a teacher, but my son did, and I've heard about you through him in the mid-80s. You graduated in 87. I have two questions here. I was hoping that you were at a transitional point between the so-called new curriculum and the present open curriculum, and I wanted you, having that experience, to comment on these two curriculums that Amherst has had, since 1952. That was, I think, the second year of the new curriculum.
Yes.
Or 1948, I think it came. So I have that question. The second one is, I noticed that you're the James E. Austin, our professor of English.
He said he liked football.
What?
Yeah. He said he liked football. Yeah. No, I said he said he liked football.
If you'll lean a little closer to the microphone, we of 1952 will pick up your words a little better. But I wanted you to comment on the coming of this patronage system, which is very widespread now in American universities. We didn't have it in our years. There were named professors, but not a patronage system as widely. The searches as widely for patrons of professors. I wonder if you'd like to comment on the consequence of that in teaching or in the relationship between the faculty. But my big question is, could you give us a, because still with us in 52, we talk about encountering a new curriculum, Professor Baird, Professor Craig, et cetera, what they did to us, to our thinking as we came out of high school, how they jerked us around and all of a sudden we were in a new mental atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. And then the changeover in the early 70s sometime, probably when you were here, to the open curriculum now. It really is not a core kind of a curriculum at all. That's the one that I'd like to value. I think I'm less interested, though it's taken over all universities now. Named professors in a patronage system.
Okay.
Two questions.
So these two infamous curriculum that you offer me, I was too young to experience any of, except when I came to Amherst, my older colleagues talked about nothing else. They missed it, or they were relieved to finally be rid of the damn thing. I had an older colleague I much admired, so I figured, I'm glad I'm not experiencing this. It passed a period in American education in general, but which Amherst really stood at the forefront of, which was an attempt to create not just a coherent curriculum, but a curriculum that would really challenge 18-year-old young men in ways they had not before. And there were many brilliant things about it. I did know Ted Baird a little. And when he found out that I supported coeducation, he refused to speak to me for the rest of his life. Ted Baird. He was, and I used to meet him on the path between Johnson Chapel and the library, and we would chat until I misbehaved. Now, I took that to be a measure of some limitation in that curriculum. And I knew some of the things he did which I thought were brilliant. But it was also a narrow curriculum in its own complicated way. It was not a simple curriculum. So I was glad to come roughly 6 or 7 years after the faculty had abolished it. So the other thing to say is that I can't be an expert at something I never actually experienced, except by hearsay. And therefore, I can't be a good defender of it, since I've always been an opponent of all forms of core curriculum. Now, that said, I think one of the serious needs and complicated problems right now is doing something with a curriculum that gives it more coherence. It's a very rich curriculum if you look through the catalog. Lots and lots of interesting things. But students leave here, unless they're in science, where things do have a kind of coherence, but they leave here without a sense of how things go together. And I think that's a perennial and necessary problem in education. How do we want students to put things together without being enclosed? How do we get them provoked and doing independent work and yet have a certain basis in that? And I can't say that we do a bad job or a good job with this. It's not a job which is talked about enough in the faculty.
How about the patronage aspect of his question?
Well, first of all, when I got made Ostendorf professor, Jim had been dead for 10 years, so there wasn't a lot of patronage involved.
Well, that's an athletic reference, so not the kind of patronage we usually see. The patronage system now usually takes from alumni who want to give money, and they've created this new way to give money.
Well,
as an endowed chair.
They exist here. It doesn't feel to me like there's anything untoward going on. I taught at Berkeley for a while, and at Berkeley, it's big money. And it is untoward. Here, you can't be a little New England college and get away with that stuff. At least I don't think you can. I might be naive. But the new president won't get away with it either.
Please.
Austin, don't be naive. Go ahead.
The first question is, how did you learn to be an Amherst teacher? And the second question is, do you have confidence that the younger generation of faculty coming into the college will learn to be what this alum called Amherst teachers?
I guess I should start with the first part. It's not for me an easy question in the following way. Some of you know that I grew up in a very small farm town. Very few people went to college. I came of age as a teacher when there were no jobs. And when I was hired at Amherst, it was for a 3-year terminal job, which I did not resent. I thought, this is my opportunity for 3 years to do what I love, and then I'm done. And then the good dean snuck me in for tenure. So in a sense, I would have to say that the first thing I learned was I had incredible colleagues in English. Incredible in the sense that no two were at all alike. I really mean that. Some were horribly unlike, but I learned from Bill Pritchard and Jack Cameron, whose manners and ways of teaching are totally unlike mine. But playing that dialogue of who am I and who are they, I think that was formative. And also, there was English 11, which I hated. But we were all in it together. So I had to learn how to fight it successfully without putting the students in the middle. And eventually, I helped get rid of it. But in the course of it, those Baird-like assignments, by the way, I learned something about assignments. And I remember Bill Heath saying to me one day, he said, you know, there are things to be learned as a teacher. This was not a revelation to me, but it was clear that he thought I hadn't learned anything. And I said, like what? And he said, no assignment should be more than 2 sentences. Now, I was still partly a Harvard student, so I wrote these horrible, the students sort of walked out and said, find somebody else. And as soon as he saw, that was a revelation to me, and it was wonderful. So I would say that I had a kind of apprenticeship, though I wouldn't at the time have thought it, but I did. And it had to do with a course that I had to struggle with. It had to do with colleagues I respected and could learn from who were totally unlike me. And the other thing is, and you of all people remember this, we had a colleague in political science who was one of the greatest teachers I ever knew. And I learned from him. So the college was, in that sense, the college was a smaller village than maybe it is now. So the second question, what confidence do I have now? I think it's probably much harder to be a young teacher now, first of all. I think it requires a dean and a tutelage system that hasn't been thought about enough yet. I think that the hiring of all the people I know has been inspired, and some of them have been sort of teachers of others. Lisa, I talked to this morning, and I think she's amazing. I thought she was amazing when I fought to hire her. So there is some interaction among the faculty that I can see. Now, how universal it is, you would know far better than I. So those are my answers.
Please.
Hey, Barry.
Hello.
You again. I would just love to hear, what are you reading or looking at or seeing these days that's either bringing you pleasure or you know, new areas of intellectual new links? Love to hear what your recommendations you might have.
Well, first of all, I have to remind you that we've been moving for 2 months, our household, and we've only 2 days ago gotten into our new place, which looks like, do these people know how to take care of anything? So, and we're far from settled. So only, my wife reads all the time, even in the midst of chaos. I admire this. I don't know how she does that. But only 4 days ago did I start reading again. So it was a sign that I was in a bed in the new place, and there was a light next to the bed. And these were huge achievements. So what I'm reading right now, if this is standing interest in me, is a novel by a man named T.C. Lau, who is a Laotian immigrant to the United States. This is his second book. I'm fascinated by the experience of people in Vietnam and Laos over the course of the last 2 decades, many of whom are here, but many of whom are not. And part of the fascination comes from Laotian and Vietnamese students I've taught at Amherst College. So I look for things by them. And I've also designed in the last 3-4 years, what one of my students said, do you only teach weird courses? And I said, that's the best compliment I've ever been paid. And she said, well, I like all these things, but they're weird. Right. So I look for lots of new literature that crosses some of the boundaries that we've been talking about. But I want good writing. So when I get to read more, I'm happy to tell you.
Please.
Hi, Barry.
Hi.
In your time in the 50 years you've been teaching, we went from an era where computers were something that was a research tool to now something that has consumed us and our psyches. Have you observed any changes in that time as to how students either engage with material, engage with text, or engage with even each other?
Good question.
Well, since I can't get my computer to work right now.
Geek squad.
And I'm deeply frustrated by it. When I first started being a graduate student, computers were a whole floor. I still have some old punch cards, actually. So I've lived through that. My first laptop, so-called, which I had in Frost Library, was this big, and so on. And now, you know, I have a computer like other people, which doesn't work. So to answer your question well, I think requires students. Because I think students think about this a lot. What I observe is, for instance, when I say I don't like to read more than a page on the computer, I always have students who agree that they feel the same way. Are they a majority? Maybe not. How? I mean, it's like here I've got digits. We all have digits. The computer is a new kind of digit. And it's impossible, I think, to live in our time without manipulating it in some way. Now, if you have a new machine like this, it changes things about how you perceive the world. How and how you describe it would take a good neurologist, not me. So,
go ahead.
So I'm going to try to pull together three things that have come up today.
Speak a little louder so everyone can hear your question.
I'm going to try to bring together three things that you've touched on today. One is the admissions department, which you say has really worked brilliantly to find and recruit and really work hard. The other is the level of infusion of athletics in the student body. My understanding is it's somewhere around 50% of students are in a sports team. And the third is, well, you're an Austin Dart professor, so you are qualified now to speak about.
This is a setup, Barry.
How does athletics, infuse the campus culture? You've said that the students are multifaceted. They bring really interesting perspectives and brilliance to the classroom. But do you feel as though the campus culture is too athleticized? That's my sense, is that with that spread, 50% of the students being on a sports team, is that something that is really just over the top?
So I'm going to try not to wander on this one. I'm not sure about your 50%, and who's in that 50% and which sports are. It is the case that non-athletes feel, as it were, divided from the life of the campus because it's dominated by athletes. Now, why is it dominated by athletes? In a way, it's a very simple answer. And again, it's something an administration has to think more about, but it's not easy. And why? Students who are athletes come in here to a pre-existing social body. And that social body is a huge advantage over the undergraduates who come without it. Now, so it's not as though there's this clump of too physical, too unbrainy people, because first of all, they're in sports. Lacrosse players do not get on with soccer players. Don't think they do, for good reason. And so on. If you're a football player, you have to think about the different positions and what that does, and you have EJ, who's as good as any teacher on the faculty. So there are many meanings to athletics, first of all. Now, does that solve your question? I don't think it does solve your question, because there needs to be a way so students who are not athletes feel they have a form of belonging that is close to athletes. That may not be possible, actually. And there, the size of the college is a disadvantage. So I try not to mention Harvard at all, because it's a terrible place, but I was an undergraduate there, and athletics, if you were a star athlete, you got in whether you could write a letter. And it's even worse now. But it was so big that, you didn't think about it. You didn't worry about it. So they went off and lifted weights and whatever else they did, and you had a good time, at least. Amherst is small. So the questions you raise, I think, are profoundly pertinent. Is how does a small place have a serious athletic program, which we do, that is not divisive in some way for the rest of the student body? Now, that's an important question, because I would fight against abolishing athletics as they are now, though I think the athletic director should go. And I think some thought has to go into who's being recruited to coach here, but that's a whole other.
All right, so wait a second. I'm going to pose a question here, because when I was here, I think probably 50% of the students were in some athletic field. They played some sport. So I'm asking everybody in this room, if you played a sport at Amherst, please raise your hand.
Can I counter that too? That I played a sport, my friends played sports, but they played different sports, and we hung out together. This stratification by team seems foreign to me and not a necessary outgrowth from having sports in a small college.
And that would be my outlook as well.
So you, typically of each of you, you're not exactly right.
Oof, oof. Tell me.
That still happens, right?
Well, we all interacted with athletes from different... I mean, we even went to DU from time to time.
So what I'm saying is mixing across teams with very few exceptions still happens. What's different is that the level of competition and as expected is divisive in this sense. That is, if you're a soccer player, we have a very great soccer coach, and year after year we have a wonderful soccer team, and he's a wonderful mentor even. But being a winning soccer team takes a lot of time. So the time issue here is part of a potential division. It's not inevitable. I actually know football players that like lacrosse players, which is sort of miraculous.
Or non-athletes, maybe. Or non-athletes too, right?
That's less likely.
Really?
It is less likely. Because social life... one of the things that happened when we rightly eliminated fraternities is we did not think through and come up with an alternative social system. And that's been, frankly, devastating. And that means that teams have extraordinarily more power, but also the level of competition now in our league is huge. We win national championships. We fight people who win national championships. It's part of the excitement, but the level. Stuart, as good as you were, you didn't have to preach.
That's an interesting point. As in, because frankly, I was a member of a fraternity. I imagine a lot of the older people here were. But, and even though it was a fraternity that was with a lot of athletes in it, we welcomed people from all parts of this, I think, of the campus. So, okay, other comments, questions, please, in the back. Barry, Bruce.
So I was here during fraternities, and that was a big hub. I'd like to see how many people in our era played more than one sport, because you could do that then.
And you can now.
And I'll put my hand up. But I know there were a lot of people who played multiple sports here, and my kids who all went here.
Okay, so let's see the hands who played more than one sport. Okay, so wait a second. Keep those hands up for a second. There's no one here, if you don't mind me saying so, folks, that's young. Okay. And that's I think that's your point. That's your point.
I prefer the term chronologically gifted. Yeah, so my three sons who all went here, all played sports, couldn't do multiple sports. It was a three-term commitment if you were on the football team.
Were they skiers?
No, they played real sports.
Okay. Please.
Hi, Barry.
I didn't know you were here.
I'm here.
She's hiding behind a mask.
So, two questions for you. First is, if you had the ability to propose to the trustee three major priorities or a couple of major priorities that you would want to see as changes for the school, what would those be? And the other is a more personal question, which is, given that teaching has been such a huge part of your life and where so much of your identity is tied up, how in retirement are you going to fulfill that same need to connect with
you? Oof. Good question.
In answer to the last one, I'm going to go to bed and not get up. But the first question is one I like to think about. The first thing I think is that the college has become over-administered in my eyes. Biddy has built a huge administration, and students complain to me, at least, all the time about not being able to find people they need. Now, this is complicated because part of the motive for her to do what she's done is to meet a range of complicated student needs. But an administration can't, in fact, do that. So thinking through how do we meet a range of student needs, far ranger than in the past, and meaningfully for the students without building a huge administration. So that's one. Two, I've actually alluded to, I think I would love to see my colleagues think hard about ways to work together across as many lines as possible. A lot of that is going on now. It would be naive to say that it's not, because a lot is. But there needs to be even more of that, I think. And the third thing, I've always thought Amherst should grow to be 3,000 students. And I think it's long overdue, and it's an answer to, or beginning of an answer to, some of these dilemmas. For instance, if you had 3,000 students, the athletic and non-athletic split would change differently. It would allow people to be on campus and have more choices of groups to belong to without belonging to one group. I think we'd gain a lot from that. So I guess those are my three.
So I'm going to ask for one more question, and after that, we'll thank Barry, but then we can stand around and ask more on a personal basis. So is there one more? Go ahead, Doug. Or is that Jim?
It's Jim.
Okay.
Hi, Barry.
Hi, Jim.
So back when we were taking American Studies, let me try to project here, there was a lot of focus in the curriculum on class issues. I remember you prescribed a book, which was barely in print, called The Land of Plenty, which was terrific, and there were other similar books. So this is a two-part question. One, do you think that there should be more emphasis on that in the current curriculum? It didn't seem like there was a lot in the list of courses. And two, more generally, are there any, over your time here, are there any topics which, in your view, have receded from prominence in teaching that you would like to see brought back to the fore a little bit more?
I think there's an enormous amount of teaching about inequality in the college, everywhere, actually. It may not name itself in a course title, but those class courses were the first of their kind here, and for a while they dropped out when the group of us left American Studies, but for the last 10 years, I'd say, wouldn't you, Austin, that inequality is a central topic? It gets named in various different ways, but I think that's one of the strengths of the current faculty. And it's not like this is inequality. No, it's crossing a range of different divides and experiences and thinking about what they mean. And that's very exciting, actually. I taught a whole course, which was really a course in inequality, but I never mentioned the word. And one of the students said to me, how am I supposed to put this together? I said, well, what do you mean? Well, we read this book, and it does this, and this book, and she listed. And I said, well, what do they have in common? And she said, well, they're sort of all unhappy. And I thought, well, that's a start. You take what you can get. So I actually don't think that class and inequality is gone at all. Jim, repeat your second question.
So the second question was more general. Are there any topics which over your time here have receded from prominence that you would like to see brought back into the forefront of teaching?
I'll start with the ones that have receded, and I'm not sure whether I want them back. I think certain forms of political science have receded. Less statistical, less authoritative. For me, political thought was always what I was interested in because the great teacher here I got the chance to work with believed in that. Political thought is still certainly taught in the poli-sci department, and I think it always should be the dominant thing. But of course, I have colleagues in political science who don't agree for a minute with me. And I don't imagine pounding them on the head and telling them how stupid they are. So another love of mine is sociology. And our sociology department almost shrunk into nothing. But there have been some brilliant additions. And Austin, has Leah left? Yeah.
No, she's not left.
She just sold her house, that's all. So there are two women in the department, especially, who are brilliant teachers and different from each other. I would like to see a bigger sociology department. And we're about, I think, to establish a department I've worked for years for, which is the Department of Asian and Asian American Studies. And I would dearly love that. I mean, Korean Americans have had a huge impact in the United States in the last 30 years, and people don't know it. And the literature that they've written is amazing. Really, for me, among the leading writers in the United States are Korean Americans. So I would like to see more of that. And one of my other lifelong pursuits was to help develop something like an education program. We now have an education studies program. It's not strongly enough, for me, supported. I think all students here should have a chance to expose themselves to public education in the United States. It is a serious part of the future, and it's a part of the future that's been incredibly endangered by the movement of private capital to buy schools, which they then misrun. So those are my three.
So, quick question. You'll still have barry.o'connell at amherst.edu email address?
B-O-C-O.
Oh, B-O...
B-O-C-O.
Okay, so B. O'Connell. B. O'Connell. So for those who want to continue to give this learned man ideas and things to continue to look into, that's his email address, b.o'connell@amherst.edu. And let's now take a moment to thank him for his 50 years of service.